The reason I asked Al to let me introduce myself is because usually a speaker introduction is supposed to tell people how the speaker might be qualified to speak on the subject they're going to talk about. And I'm not sure exactly what would qualify a person to talk about Gnosticism other than being a know-it-all. But whatever the qualifications are, I probably don't have them. So in lieu of qualifications, I thought I might tell you how I got interested in the subject, which is a fairly recent interest. It's only about 5 or 6 years that I've actually been looking into Gnosticism. And the thing is that interests me in retrospect, of course, is that when I sort of drifted into this interest, I had no idea that there was such a thing as modern Gnosticism. I certainly had no idea that there was such a thing as Unitarian Gnosticism. I was only aware of the ancient classical Gnosticism. So it's been a revelation and educational experience for me, just looking into the aspects of this. But basically, the reason I drifted into it was because of my philosophical interest, because I'm a Platonist. And a lot of the cosmological assumptions of Gnostics are, in fact, Platonic. So when I started coming across Gnostic writings, I discovered that I was dealing with a world that was already somewhat familiar to me, although somewhat more chaotic and much less systematic. Now, everybody here has probably heard the famous quip by that philosopher whose name I seem to have forgotten for a moment. Who was it? That'll come back later, yeah. Yeah. Alfred North Whitehead, that's the fella, mathematician and philosopher, who said that all of Western philosophy consists of footnotes to Plato. So, for instance, if we were, as an example, to take 20th century British linguistic philosophy, it turns out that that whole philosophical school is a footnote to a line in the Republic where Socrates answers one of his more obstreperous interlocutors by saying, "Before you speak to me, you must first define your terms." As soon as he says that, then Ayer and Wittgenstein and all those guys become inevitable. So if I'm going to talk about Gnosticism, it seems like I ought to first define the term. But I have a bit of a problem there in that, although I believe, and I think I can circumstantially demonstrate the continuity of ancient Gnosticism and modern Gnosticism, I can't rigorously demonstrate it in either a scientific or a philosophical way. So I'm just going to have to be the cat in the hat and introduce you to thing number one and thing number two. Thing number one will be classical Gnosticism, which I'm going to describe rather than define. I'll just put some spatial and temporal boundaries around it by saying that it occurred within the Roman Empire and within the first 3 centuries of the Christian era. And I'll describe it in a second. And then for the further developments of Gnosticism, I'll offer this as a definition, that Gnosticism would describe any salvational religion in which salvation is dependent on knowledge. And with the caveat, of course, that salvation can be defined in a number of different ways by different religious traditions. Okay. So, starting with classical Gnosticism, it's sheer chaos. Even if we restrict ourselves to the first 3 centuries of the Christian era and the Roman Empire, we find this amazing variety of denominations or sects or what you will. We have Sethians, Ophites, Cainites, Corpocratians, Mandeans, Valentinians, and on and on. There's at least 24 of these groups that are known to us, and they never had any sort of a central organization that would impose a uniform dogma on them. So basically, whatever whatever vision the charismatic pneumatic that was preaching this particular religion had obtained, that would be the faith of his followers. And there was a lot of variety in those faiths, but there were also some common elements. Among the common elements was the fact that just all of these groups had a somewhat Trinitarian view of humanity, which is to say they broke humanity up into three distinct classes of people. There were two classes of people within the Gnostic community, and then there was that huge class of people that was unfit to be within the Gnostic community. These people were the three groups were known as pneumatics, who were the people who knew, the psychics, who were the people who wanted to know, who wanted to develop spiritually, and the hylix, from a Greek word for matter, the materialists, the unspiritual, and the people who were not going to hear what you had to say no matter what. And this threefold division of humanity is pretty much a constant throughout all Gnostic groups. I'm going to tell you a creation story, a Gnostic creation story. This will give you some idea of what sort of a religion or a philosophy we're talking about here. This is largely Valentinian. As I said, there was huge variations. There were all sorts of ideological differences between Gnostic groups. And as I said, there was no organization to reconcile them. In fact, the people who needed some sort of uniform orthodoxy tended to drift into Christianity, which is where Christianity got its origins. All of these people were the heretics who valued their own opinions more than any form of orthodoxy. So, all right, in this creation story, in the beginning is the One. See, we all start out as Unitarians. But the One has many characteristics, many qualities, many features, which emanate from the One. And since these emanations are all perfect, being emanations from the perfect, they have the perfection of personality. So from the One, we get many. How many? Well, that varies. 10, 12, 24, 30. It depends on the particular denomination, on the particular vision of the people in that denomination. But the last of these emanations was called wisdom, Sophia. Sometimes Hagia Sophia, holy wisdom. And it's really a strange name because the subsequent story shows us wisdom not acting very wisely, actually making some serious mistakes, which result in the creation of the lesser existence that we know. But wisdom is jealous of the One, and this is one version. There are a number of versions. But in any case, wisdom decides to duplicate the emanation from the One. And what emanates from wisdom is an inferior deity called the Demiurge, the Creator. And this inferior deity subsequently creates six blessed deities known as the Archons, and subsequently the world as we know it is all created by the Demiurge. At this point, the final step in the creation is of course human beings. and the demiurge creates human beings, but they don't work. In various versions, they're either inert or they're animals. But Sophia has compassion for this inferior creation and breathes her own spirit into humanity, so that something of the divine element, in spite of our inferior creation, something of the divine element is within us. And now the question, and this is where the whole idea of gnosis, knowledge, comes in, because we don't know this. We don't know our history. We don't know that we're actually have something divine within us. Somebody has to tip us off. So emanating from the Pleroma, which is the only emanations of the One, we have a Redeemer who is essentially a messenger. And the function of this messenger is to tell us, to inform us, that we have some element of divinity within us. And if we nurture that divinity, we can reunite with the Pleroma from which that portion of us came. But if we are distracted or taken in by the inferior creation, then of course we lose that opportunity. So this is a short version of Gnosticism, and it sounds really peculiar. And why would we even be interested in this? Well, one of the things that grabbed my interest right away, of course, is that this notion of human divinity, which is also true in Hinduism, actually provides an ontological foundation for ethics. Insofar, I mean, if we recognize some element of divinity in each other, it seems to logically follow that we ought to treat each other better than we might otherwise. So, one of the ongoing problems is to justify in any kind of logical way why we should be good to each other. And this certainly seems like a good excuse. okay, so this Gnostic Redeemer had different names in different groups. For instance, the Valentinians referred to him as Adam, or the original Adam. The Sethians referred to him as Seth. In most of these groups, the Redeemer was connected with the origin of humanity. This was like the archetype of humanity. This was man with a capital M, was more or less equivalent of this Redeemer. However, most of the preachers of the various Gnostic schools identified themselves with this Redeemer. Basically, their position was that this Redeemer had appeared to them and revealed all of this truth, which they were now revealing to other people. So, in part, they were playing this role of the Redeemer for their congregation, simply by conveying these truths to their congregation. So, there's certain similarities here with some notions that crop up in Christianity and some other religions, but there's a huge difference between Gnostic and Christian views that created a lot of hostility and resulted in the Gnostics basically being run out of business in the Roman Empire once the Christians got to have to be the official religion of the Roman Empire. And the basic difference, of course, is that in the Christian view, the world is okay, but people are inherently defective due to original sin. You know, we're bad. Doesn't matter how good we try to be, we're still bad. And we ought to be guilty. In the Gnostic view, it's the world that's somewhat damaged and inferior, whereas people are inherently good. We have this divinity in us by virtue of wisdom having breathed our soul into us, and therefore the defects in our lives are either because we're ignorant of our own true nature, or simply because the world is a very nasty, hostile place that it's hard for us to deal with. So this is pretty fundamental difference of views. Now, both of these views have some psychological validity. I mean, we've all been in situations where we personally have fouled up and have felt very responsible and very regretful about it. And we've also been in situations where we were completely righteous, and whatever powers it be in that situation really unjustly penalized us for something we weren't responsible for. We've all been in both of those situations, and we can see the psychological validity of those worldviews. Of course, we're Unitarians, so we're much more tolerant than many other groups of people have been in the past. As I said, once Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, then the entire force of the state was used to persecute heretics. And they began just by arresting them and stealing their property, but as the hostility deepened, it became a capital crime and people were simply executed. That's a story that gets told over and over. And that's as much as I'm going to tell you about classical Gnosticism. As I said, there were many variations. Well, let me just tell you about one variation: the Ophites. Ophis is Greek for snake, and the Ophites were snake worshippers, in a sense. They began with the Genesis story, okay. But they said that since the Genesis deity was in fact the inferior demiurge, the snake, the serpent, was actually the bringer of wisdom to Adam and Eve. That the eating of the apple was not an original sin at all, but it was a model for Gnostics to follow to transcend the place that they were and find the true knowledge that would bring them to a real awareness of who they were and reunite them with their own real roots. So consequently, the Ophites had the snake was their symbol and was their practically an idol, and this connected them up with a number of pagan traditions. For instance, in Egypt, the feathered snake was a symbol of wisdom. The feather representing the quill pen that the scribes used. In Greece, Athena, the goddess of wisdom, had snakes as among her symbols, and the Delphic oracle actually kept pet snakes in the oracle that were fed bowls of milk by the priestesses. So we have a sort of a synthesis in Gnosticism, in classical Gnosticism, between Egyptian, Jewish, and Greek religious beliefs. And that leads me to suspect that a lot of these ideas were originally put together in Alexandria, which was the second major city in the Roman Empire, which had a population of Egyptians, Jews, and Greeks. So, but they. The classical Gnostics, as I said, they didn't survive. They were wiped out by the rising Christians. Outside the Roman Empire, they did a little better. The one Gnostic group, well, I won't say the one, but the first Gnostic group to actually get organized were the Manichaeans. And they originated in Iraq. So we have to take a trip to Iraq in order to understand these folks. But we're taking the magic carpet tour, so we won't need any weapons or body armor. We'll just do this mind experiment back to the second century in Iraq, where there was an amazing prophet named Mani, from whom Manichaeism is named. Now, at this time in Iraq, then like today, it was a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-confessional society. Islam hadn't been invented yet, so the multi-confessions that we had in Iraq included Zoroastrians, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Gnostics. In fact, before I get into Manichaeans, I should mention back when Americans still had illusions that they were actually going to win the war in Iraq and create a new society, we had a lot of anthropological articles in the newspapers. So you probably heard something about the Marsh Arabs who live south of Basra. And the religion of these people is Mandean. These people are Mandeans, which is a form of Gnosticism. And the interesting, to me, fascinating thing about their form of Gnosticism is that their personal redeemer is John the Baptist. So these folks are neither Jews nor Christians nor Muslims, but they are very closely related to all three. They're coming out of the same tradition, and they're still there. You know, most of the Gnostics, for instance, the Manichaeans had a good run. They lasted over 1,000 years, but they're pretty much non-existent at this point. Well, except that when I get to the end of this talk, I'm going to tell you about the great American Manichaean novel that was written by a Unitarian. But that apart, the Manichaeans are basically out of business now. But as I said, they began with a prophet named Mani, who was born in Iraq. And at the age of 12, he had a revelation that he should be a prophet. And then nothing much happened until he was around 25. And then he had another vision that confirmed him in his vocation, and he started preaching Manichaeism. Interesting thing about Iraq in the second century is that it was part of Iran. Not only was it part of Iran, but the Iranian capital was located in Iraq, just a few miles south of where Babylon now is, where Baghdad now is, at a place called Ctesiphon. So Mani was within the Persian Empire, and when he began preaching, one of his first converts was the Shah of Iran. So he actually had government protection for about 20 years while he developed his religion. Then that particular Shah died. Another one took over. The one that took over next was tight with the Zoroastrian priesthood, and they were really ticked off at Mani because he was cutting into their church. And one thing and another, Mani got arrested and ultimately executed by the government. So, but his version of Gnosticism was interesting in that it drew heavily on the Zoroastrian religion. And the Zoroastrian religion, of course, we have two deities, a good deity and a bad deity. Ahura Mazda is the good deity representing truth, light, all the good qualities, and Ahriman is the bad deity who represents all the evil. And we have this perpetual battle between good and evil. And the function of humanity in this perpetual battle between good and evil is to pick your side and put up a good fight. Well, Mani basically incorporated all of this into his Gnosticism. In classical Gnosticism, your basic dualism was between spirit and matter. You see, we were blinded by the material world, and we had to overcome our ignorance in order to transcend the material world and reunite with our spiritual self. But in the Manichaean version, this becomes conflated with good and evil. We are born in this evil world, which is trying to keep us from knowing our good self. And so our struggle is to defeat this evil. As we save ourselves, we're also supporting the good and attacking the evil. And this is Manichaeism. A simple version. As I said, it actually developed into a fairly complex church organization. So it wasn't just philosophical discussion groups. It had prayers and hymns and rituals and all the appurtenances of a church. And again, you have the tripart division of humanity, the dual division of the church itself, in which the upper echelon, the people who knew, were called the elect. And the other people were just the faithful. They were trying to learn from the elect. And the elect typically wore white as a demonstration of their purity. And the main thing that the elect did to affirm their elect status was, of course, they couldn't do bad stuff. They had to be good. They had to be good people. They had to act good all the time. Any deviation from that proved that they were not of the elect, and therefore, so you have a sort of a proto-Calvinism built into this Manichaean religion. And these folks lasted well into the 14th century, I think. After that, I don't think we have any record of them. I'm doing this very quickly, just touching the surface, but I'm going to jump ahead about 1,000 years and tell you about a group in southern France known as the Albigensians, who were another Gnostic group. One of the things that bothered me when I first started looking at the Albigensians is I couldn't tell whether I should actually call them Gnostics or Manichaeans, you know, which form of dualism. And it turned out to be an impossible call because the Inquisition accused them of being Manichaeans. On the other hand, the Inquisition had an axe to grind. And most of the information they collected was collected under torture, which, as we're learning again, often produces dubious information. So at this point, I think maybe it's a distinction that isn't worth making. But broadly, they're obviously Gnostics. Again, we have the division between the good people and the followers. In the case of the Albigensians, the good people, the elite, are known as perfecti, the perfect ones, and the followers are known as credentes, the believers. The French finally launched a crusade against the Albigensians, known as the Albigensian Crusade. And the thing that happened was that, the perfecti could not defend themselves. because violence was against their religion. It was not part of being perfect. Obviously, you can't harm another being and still be perfect. So the defense of the Albigensians fell on the Credentes, who were basically relying on the Perfecti to put in a good word with them, with God, for them. And then, even though they had to go out and kill some Frenchmen in order to protect their community. And not to sneak it, I'm gonna signal this right out in the open that I'm gonna give you a relief from theology for a couple of seconds so that I can talk about the Albigensians in a more political way. Okay? Because when I think about the Albigensian crusade, when the French invaded the Languedoc and started butchering people because of their religion, it reminds me in certain respects of Bush's little crusade over in Iraq. For instance, the siege of Béziers, which happened in 1209, in which the population was totally slaughtered and the place sacked and torn down, is not dissimilar from the siege of Fallujah that took place last year. And there's an interesting story about the siege of Béziers that concerns the commanding bishop of the French forces. They used to have bishops running armies back in those days. The term church militant actually was fairly serious. I heard they were thinking of reviving this at the Air Force Academy, but the commanding bishop was giving his troops a pep talk. And his pep talk is, you know, hey, you know, we're going to take this city. You got to make sure you kill all these heretics. You know, don't get tired. You know, just make sure you kill them all. And some knight who was really too smart to be in this line of work, you know, he should have been doing something more scholarly. But anyway, he says, "Your Eminence, well, you know, there are Catholics as well as heretics in this town. How are we going to tell them apart?" And the commanding bishop says, "Kill them all and let God sort them out." Now this, I think people may remember that this became an unofficial slogan of the Green Berets in the Vietnam mess, and I understand it's been picked up again by some of the folks in Iraq, which kind of shows you the continuity of Western civilization, you know, how it just kind of hangs in there and sings the same old song. The other interesting political development in this Albigensian crusade, of course, was at some point the church decided it needed a specialized organization to root out all these heretics, so it organized the Order of the Holy Inquisition to do this job. And so after the military operations, these guys would come up behind and round up all the local heretics and torture them to get more names of more heretics, and then torture them and get more names of more heretics, and kill them all. And after about 50 years of doing this, they had pretty much wiped out all the Albigensians, and therefore the Inquisition had no further reason to exist. So they naturally disbanded themselves, right? No. No, they went looking around for other heretics to chase, and they found new enemies to fight, and the Inquisition actually maintained itself in that nasty and virulent form for about 650 years, I think. And even when it was downsized a couple of centuries ago, there was still a rump organization in the Vatican, which was the continuation of the Office of the Inquisition. And in fact, that rump organization was what the current Pope was running before he became Pope. So So history is wonderful. You know, the more history you know, the more fun you have. Okay, that'll complete the political portion of the program. An interesting thing about this is that while the French were busy wiping out the Albigensians and the Inquisition was hunting these folks down, there was another form of Gnosticism flourishing in southern France that pretty much was under the radar of the Inquisition, and that was Kabbalah. In Kabbalah, the eons, the emanations of the deity are known as Sephiro, and there are 10 of them, and they are hierarchically organized as they are in all different forms of Gnosticism. As in other forms of Gnosticism as well, this is not just a description of the nature of the deity. This is also a description of the architecture of the human soul. Heaven is directly reflected in each of us, and our own psychic composition is a mirror of the structure of the universe, of the spiritual universe. So this is another element of Gnosticism. The question arises, when we look at any of these particular Gnosticisms, the Albigensians vis-a-vis Christianity, they always claim that they were just good Christians. I tend to doubt that because of the social structure of the community, as I indicated, and because, well, for instance, they believed in reincarnation. If your punishment was being bad, was that you got another lifetime in this mess. You had to keep living here over and over and over again until you finally decided to be a good person and graduate. So this is hell. Okay, so the question is, to what extent do the Albigensians, the Kabbalists, the Sufis represent something alien to Christianity or Judaism or Islam? To what extent are they part of it? The fact is that these Gnostic notions have always re-arisen in people who have serious spiritual interests, but they always arise within a context, and a lot of the way that these ideas are illustrated, a lot of the mythology that gathers around these ideas is drawn directly from whatever religious tradition the ideas appear in. So at the same time that the Kabbalah is Gnostic, it's also very Jewish. At the same time that Sufism is Gnostic, it's also very Muslim. And as I said, the Albigensians always call themselves the good Christians. That was how they thought of themselves. And it's just that we've noticed the similarity in some of these sociological details that we can really see that there is something here that actually transcends a particular religious tradition and has a certain universal quality to it. Okay, I think I can, yeah. I'm going to jump ahead again, a huge jump, and talk about American Gnosticism. Gnosticism came to America in three distinct waves. The first wave before the Civil War was called the New Views. The second wave after the Civil War and really climaxing in the 1880s and 1890s was known as New Thought. New Thought gave us things like theosophy and religious science, and also the most dogmatic modern Gnosticism, Christian Science, and a number of spiritual churches and so forth. And then the third wave in the 1960s was called New Age. So we had new views, new thought, new age, three distinct waves of Gnostic religion in the United States, also with some European connections. And the thing that fascinates me about all of this is that the first wave, the new views, was also known as Transcendentalism, and it was owned and operated by Unitarians. We're talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau and the Reverend Bronson Alcott and the Reverend Theodore Parker and a lot of other Unitarians who were well known in their time but have become less known to us today. And the basic idea is that it is what we know that is going to save us. It is our knowledge, our spiritual insight that is the true religion, and that dogmas imposed on us from outside are useless. And if you read Emerson does this again and again. His classic essay on self-reliance, what is he talking about? He's talking about rely on your own soul, rely on the divine within you, and don't be dependent on the opinions that come from outside, because they're dead. If it's outside you, it's dead. The living religion is what is in your soul and in your heart. And this was also true of Thoreau and the rest of this, the Transcendentalists. I implied without really getting into it that a lot of the classical Gnosticism was based on Platonism, on that philosophical frame of reference, and a great deal of Transcendentalism was based on a more modern idealist, Immanuel Kant, who was known directly or indirectly to all of the Transcendentalists. Actually, I think Thoreau and the Reverend Theodore Parker were the only ones who actually read Kant. He was only available in German at that time, so you had to know German in order to read him. Emerson and most of the other Transcendentalists got their Kant indirectly through Coleridge and other interpreters. But the Kantian idealism was very much a part of that movement. My last minute, I want to talk about the great American Manichaean novel. I think some of you people have heard me make a joke about I become a Manichaean every time I read the newspaper. It seems like every time I pick up a newspaper, I find new proof that the devil was running this world. But the great American Manichaean novel written by a Unitarian, of course, is Moby Dick. Probably the greatest novel ever written by an American. And the first time I read Moby Dick, I knew it was not only a good novel, but a profoundly religious novel, profoundly spiritual novel. And I interpreted it as being the story of an anti-hero, Ahab, who was being punished by God for his abuse of the environment. That was reflecting my own environmental concerns. That interpretation actually survived the second reading. And then I made the mistake of reading the critics. And I discovered that almost unanimously, the critics thought that Moby Dick was a demonic force, and that Captain Ahab was the hero who took it on himself to hunt down and destroy evil wherever he found it, and who was a martyr to that cause. And since I read about five or six different critics who all had the same interpretation, I began to doubt my own opinion. But the fact that I'm let me say that I'm comfortable with contradictions. I can walk around with two entirely contradictory ideas in my head at the same time for the longest time, and simply say, well, I don't have enough information to settle the argument, and I'll wait. I'm patient enough to wait until I get the information. And once I began looking into Gnosticism, within the last couple of years, I ran across an author who was talking about modern Gnosticism, and he mentioned Melville and described Melville as a Manichaean. And I said, wait a minute, that's it. That makes it all fit. Moby Dick can be the deity, but as a Manichaean, that would be an evil and malignant deity. And Ahab is attempting to transcend the gods of this world and achieve his own self-realization. And that is the project in which he dies, pursuing. So so recognizing Melville as a Manichaean actually resolved a long-lasting argument in my own mind about whether I was right or the critics were right in their interpretation of Moby Dick. And also the fact that one of the most famous Unitarians is a Manichaean makes me somewhat more comfortable in asserting that view in the Unitarian Church.